Edwin's experience with computers began by falling asleep at night to the soothing sounds of a teletype ASR-33 being used by his father in the living room of their house to run jobs on a GE-626 mainframe. The GE was the first timeshare computer, and Jim touched on that, I believe, or that was Marvin, maybe, or never mind.
Well, touched on the core plan that came out of the GE, right?
There you go, okay. The GE was the first timeshare computer, and Edwin's father could only get the large blocks of time he needed for his electron beam trajectory simulations late at night or over the holidays. Later on, his father taught him how to program BASIC on the terminal, and he has been a bit whacker ever since. That's his own description, bit whacker. By the late 70s, Edwin realized that computers were getting to be too popular, and that even then, at the age of 19 and after 3 years of college, he was going to be facing a lot of competition in the field, especially by those younger than he was. Being that he is inherently lazy and violently opposed to being poor, he searched for the slowest changing but still lucrative field in electrical engineering, which was his major. He found electrical power and industrial controls to be dominated by very old and stodgy guys, with none of his classmates having even a neutral interest in that field. So he greedily sensed opportunity and has been direct depositing to the bank ever since. He still programs in BASIC and has made most of his fortune fixing and programming automatic manufacturing machinery. He has recently been enjoying the rapid influx of computers into his field. He especially enjoys making money by fixing failed projects that tried to use all the newfangled software such as C, objects, AI, GUIs, and Unix in the field of industrial manufacturing. He usually replaces their flops with BASIC programs running on 8-bit micros and 386s. He might even tell you his secrets of how old technology can still make lots of money at one of his presentations. So be sure to start taking notes. Edwin L. Corret.
One of the jobs I had in college was to work for NCR Corporation, and I got the job because I had a programming lab. I was doing an Apple II in control systems lab, and I used to irritate my lab partner no end by putting comment cards all throughout the program. He wanted to just get out of it. I put in the comment cards and insisted on it because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And he went and interviewed NCR. And he said, "I know just the guy you need." I think I landed up there longer than anybody else who was programming Pascal or Arithmetic and stuff because it worked. There's two presentations. This will be my first one. I'll try and make it pretty quick. I'm with this organization, Computer History Association of California. We're a nonprofit organization. We're trying to collect computer history from the nonprofit side, as rather being collectors like most of you, and certainly like Sam. I'd like to run over a few items. More interesting for you, most probably, is the fundamentals of why we're doing things, who we're doing it with, some idea of when we get called, because after all, you would like to know where we get the stuff too, you may think. How it is given to us, not this way, but how do we find it? What condition is it in? What do we have to do in order to be able to get it? You notice the word that's used underneath that, excavation. Frank is smiling here. It's definitely excavation. Talk a little bit about our responsibilities of ownership and how we handle storage and some ideas to that end, which we hope might be of useful to you as collectors. Talk a bit about the concepts of conservation, preservation, and renovation. And then our most difficult subject, which I'll most probably punt most of which off to the panel discussion following me, is the issue of what do you do with it after you've gotten it? What do you do with it then? And with the label of concept of fenestration, well, I had to look for something with shun. And fenestration is doors and windows, or those things in which we enter structures with or look into them. So given the Microsoft's usage of a fenestration word for their software, I thought that was reasonably appropriate. talk a bit about our reasons for existence. The first one, I think, is one we can get pretty good agreement with. Basically, to preserve the computers, the software, the documentation, for future generations. That it doesn't go to the dump. Although the dump most probably, in some aspects, might be able to preserve it for future generations better than most of us can.
It's hard to access.
Very hard to access, and the trouble is that we are most probably going to be commingling it with other artifacts from other aspects of our lives, which may be not so desirable. Or maybe very confusing. I mean, after all, we wouldn't want people to realize that Macintosh was a religious icon. Second point is what I consider to be actually more valuable than the tangibles, and that's the intangible, the stories. What people have been sharing all today in this room, as opposed to what people have been sharing in that room. It's the stories. Stories that may not be already in print. Stories that are actually not of much interest to institutions like the Smithsonian, or the Computer Museum of Boston, or the news media. The stories that have not made it into the current lore. And there are quite a few of them. Quite a few that we have inklings that are out there, but we have not been able to secure yet. And the third one, which I think Sam is doing an excellent job at pushing, is to increase the awareness or increase the value of the subject matter. And this will become telling as we get further into the presentation why this is going to be important. I'll give you some idea of who I play with. I've mentioned CHAC. Our goal is to stick to California. In doing so, we've had to form alliances with other organizations. One organization is the Perham Foundation, which is a local electronics museum. It used to be at Foothill College. They got evicted when Foothill College decided that computer classes were more interesting than old radios and computers. It's been in storage ever since. Quite honestly, I don't think it's going to turn into a real structure for another 5 to 10 years. I'll talk a bit about the reasons for that a little later. Perham does have sufficient storage for CHAC to collect. It has 32 seagoing containers, of which CHAC is now at about 3 and growing, packed full. And the last organization here is one that we've been kind of negotiating with on and off for the past year and a half. They started in business about 2 years ago with the sale of the Nixdorf Computer Corporation to Siemens, the proceeds of which was left by Heinz Nixdorf, the founder of Nixdorf, to a foundation, and that foundation produced a entity called the Heinz Nixdorf Museums Forum. And back in the other hall, I have left a bunch of these flyers on that museum. For those of you who didn't get it, I'll pass this around. Go ahead. If there's any more, let me know. I have good news and bad news. The bad news is this thing's over in Germany. The good news is that this thing is big. Best I know, this is the biggest computer history museum in the world. The first, inside the flyer, on the inside cover, inside of the first flap, top left, is a picture of the building. That's the old Nixdorf headquarters building. 5+ stories. What they doesn't show you is 2 wings off the side. Tremendous amount of square footage. What you've got on that side is the floor plan. They didn't even use all the stories. That's for expansion in the future. They've got the entire proceeds of the sale of a significant computer corporation as the basis of their foundation. Millions of dollars. That's the good news. The bad news is they're in Germany. The bad news is that here in the heart of Silicon Valley, or in Santa Barbara, or in Seattle, or in Redmond, there is very little money and very little significant resources to hold on to computer history. From a nonprofit point of view, we try playing with all of those people to meet our goals. Go back to that. Talk about when we are called. Nonprofit, we get phone calls. We have such and such, do you want it? The answer is yes, almost regardless. Reason for that is we rarely get the accurate description of what it is that they're giving us. Sometimes it's described as we have this pile of electronic stuff in the garage, please take it. This relates a bit of how it is given in the fact that the reason we get called is not by somebody who likes computers on average. It's by somebody who was married to somebody who likes computers, who just passed away, and or likes stuff, period. Not even, it looks like a computer, or it looks like electronics, or it looks like junk, or whatever. It has cobwebs all over it. And we need to have it cleaned out, because I don't want to see it anymore. And this is not an easy situation, because first of all, you're going to get the entire garage, and they want you to take the entire garage, bicycles, and everything in it. The other thing is that this was of great sentimental importance to the person who passed away, and that person was of great sentimental importance to the person who's giving you the stuff. So two things. One is they don't want you to leave anything behind, but two, they don't want to hear about what you're going to do with throwing away 90% of it either, because there's a sentimental attachment to it. By the time most people pass away and give things to a nonprofit, the person's usually in some stage of debilitation for quite a number of years, lending to the word excavation. Collection isn't maintained, garages tend to encrust and accumulate. Computers are rarely thrown away in Silicon Valley. They're generally put into closets, garages, attics, backyards, underneath eaves, covered with plastic. Sometimes the plastic doesn't last very long, like one winter and that's it. But that was done 10 years ago and the guy's never put the plastic over since. I mean, it's like they're shreds of plastic, but it's, so it kind of looks like it's covered, but it really isn't. As you all well know, computers did not sell for cheap when they were being sold brand new. As such, people are very reluctant to throw away an item that was at one time worth a lot of money. The pickings for computer history are very good in Silicon Valley in my eyes. Last year just got completed a first round of studies by some sociologists out of San Jose State University about what really is Silicon Valley. And what they found is that when computers are purchased, they're typically purchased by the alpha male of the household, and they're given to some member of the household to use. Now, if you can kind of imagine, we're not talking about a person like us being the alpha male purchasing. We're talking about the person who's either stockbroker, truck driver, whatever, a non-technical person purchasing this item and giving it to some person in the household to use, because that's what I think you should do in order to be what I want you to be. Okay? Very important to understand what we're talking about, where, how this stuff was acquired and what its purpose was. Because the next step is, you know how long that's going to be used by that person, right? We don't have memory that has access times that short. Sub-nanosecond, right. So that means that it most probably got pulled out of the box, it got looked at, got attempted to be assembled, maybe some games got played on it, And after a very short period of time, people got bored with it, and it went into the closet or any of those storage things I talked to you about, and it got forgotten about, but it never got thrown away. You can't throw away something like that because, number one, you'd be offending the alpha male, and number two, it cost a hell of a lot of money, relatively speaking. So that stuff sits until the alpha male disappears, they have to move and sell the house, or some other traumatic event happens to them, at which point we get the call. And of course, we don't get the call for one computer, we get the call for every single obsolete computer that's the entire household. Now, sometimes computers get traded in along the neighborhood or along the subculture that's there. I give the next lower person on the totem pole the hand-me-down computer to the, you know, to the next family unit, whatever. So sometimes they stay in for quite some time, even though the household that originally purchased it disappears. What I'm telling you is that there are a ton of computers out there in Silicon Valley and most probably every other neighborhood in America, possibly the world. Tons of them. I don't think computers got thrown away. Mainframes, yes. Minis, yes, because those are corporate, and corporate pays by square foot. And bosses don't like to have clutter around. But household computers, personal computers, a different story. So from a collection point of view, it's an endless sink. Which brings us to the next item on the list here. Conservation, preservation, renovation, ownership, storage. What do we do with this stuff? How do we handle it? Well, first of all, in California, we got a problem with spiders. Spiders everywhere. Spiders love the interior of computers. I don't know if they know how to program, but they certainly seem to find solace in there. If you pack stuff in cardboard boxes, you invite another friendly multi-legger, silverfish. Now, you don't care about the cardboard box, but you do care about the manuals. You care about the sleeves for the floppies. You care about just physically having certain organic detritus in the wrong place. Proteins do have some conductive value, especially at the wrong location. So one of the first things we've done with the collection as we received it was to get rid of all the cardboard boxes, all the unnecessary packing material. Let's face it, if it's a genuine, original, as it was shipped, Atari box with 7 layers of gummed tape and 5 layers of duct tape on it, its historical value is kind of marginal. For those of you who want to collect that, I have an endless stream I can give you. We tend to recycle that, although I wonder how well you could recycle some of that stuff. The plastic content's bigger than the paper content. After you've done that, you have left the artifacts, but the trouble is that they're kind of sitting around, little pieces like we had here with the PC, you know, it's got the mouse dangling and the cables and all their stuff. What do you do with that? Very nicely, General Motors and Ford and Chrysler have come to our rescue. They got sick and tired of cardboard boxes too. It's costing them an absolute fortune handling them. And they commissioned companies who make packing supplies to come up with reusable containers. Things that you can either nest or knock down to be shipped back to the supplier, refilled up with the parts, and sent back to Detroit to make new cars. This happened about 10 years ago, more or less, and has since trickled down to us poor minions in the form of the Contico, a trade name that you can get from Costco or just about anywhere else, the plastic things with the lids, the totes. These have a number of advantages over the traditional storage method of cardboard boxes. One, plastic is not as flammable as paper, as cardboard, corrugated cardboard. Corrugated cardboard is, in essence, a fuel oxidizer mix, because of the corrugations, and when that thing catches fire, it goes really fast and is absolutely the pain for fire protection. Plastic does burn, but it tends to smolder. If you remove the source of ignition away, it tends to self-extinguish. Tends to. Plastic is also not a wicking agent. It does not absorb water, at least not the plastic Contecos are made out of. So if you have the other problem in California of occasional flooding, you have a Conteco on the ground, you have 1.5 feet of flooding capable before it's going to affect what's inside of it. The other thing is that if you are lucky enough to have your stuff in a sprinkler area, the lidded containers like this, with the interlocking fingers, they will allow water in. But if you have like the Tupperware type containers with the continuous single piece lid that snaps on, you can have that sprinkler go off, and if it's inside that container, it is not going to damage it. Now, one of the things we took a look at in designing the new Perim structure that'll be built hopefully one of these decades was how to handle fire protection for the collection. And we had some of our older members adamant, we're not going to have sprinkler systems and sprinkler pipes over the collection. And on the other hand, fire protection people adamant that water sprinkling is the most effective way of preserving anything of value, whether it be electronics, rare books, anything, in a raging fire. Nothing else comes close. So knowing those two things, knowing what a Contico or its equivalent can do, and knowing what a sprinkler system can also do to protect your collection, and last of all, knowing that these Contecos are steadily dropping in price to the point where they're almost as inexpensive as a cardboard box, that this becomes a very handy technology. I'd like to point that out to collectors to think about using also. The other thing is that they stack to the ceiling and rather efficiently, as long as the object you're trying to put into them fits. Now, obviously, most of the computers themselves don't fit into the Contico size, but there are larger sizes available, and they are nowhere as expensive as getting custom boxes. Plastic containers also have another advantage, and that is that another threat to collections is insects. Now, in a plastic container, you're going to grow as many insects as you're going to grow in any other container, but you have some tricks you can put up your sleeve. If you get a block of dry ice and you drop it in the Contico and close it, you in essence have CO2 in an area where most animals like to have oxygen. Yeah, beyond a certain percentage, about 15 to 20% of CO2, not 100%, just 15%, 20%, most life, apart from plants, doesn't exist, ceases to. Certainly insects, which are your major culprits. Now, I can't do anything about fungus, which likes the CO2, but if you've gotten rid of the water, you've also gotten rid of the fungus and the mildew. You can also flood the container with insecticide. You can get a cylinder of CO2 and flood the container. And you can do those things without worrying about hurting yourself, because a big problem of flooding the whole room with CO2 is that you're an organic life form yourself. But if you do each individual one, you can get away with it, and you have a very effective insect control mechanism that does not use the old style one of the museums, and that is the ethylene chloride, is it? Name escapes me. Nasty poison that was used by libraries in the 60s and 70s to get rid of silverfish. You put the books in this autoclave-like thing, you flooded it with this nasty chemical, hopefully vented the chemical off somewhere, you know, off into the ozone, opened it up, pulled out the books, okay? Now, nobody wants to do that anymore. The CO2 method works, it's not 100%, nothing is really, but it works, and you can continue using that fairly inexpensively, whereas I don't imagine chemicals are that cheap anymore these days. Enough on storage. Let's talk about these three words here. Is conservation the same as preservation? Does anybody feel that that's the same? Raise your hands. Does anybody feel it's not the same? Raise their hands. Big debate in the museum world, the difference between conservation and preservation. Preservation is, I accept it as I receive it, I will clean off the cobwebs and dust it a bit and the like, but I won't do much more to it. Conservation is like California Conservation Corps. We don't like those weeds in the yard, we're going to remove them. Or we think that the painting on the side of King Tut's tomb is a little bit faded, so we're going to go back and touch it up. Renovation is even further than conservation. Renovation is complete rebuild. And you see that in a lot of things, in furniture, in musical instruments, but you don't see it as much in paintings anymore. Don't see it as much in books, works of art. One of the things you want to take a look at from point of view of collecting is, what of these are you willing to do? What do you want to do? And what are you doing to succeeding generations' ability to appreciate it after you've done it? And don't think that preservation is necessarily the best thing. Because I can tell you a couple things that are not so good about preservation. No matter what the hell you do to some of these things, they're going to self-destruct. Good old foam inside of certain devices, especially IBM foam. The powder coat paint on an IBM computer. It was not sticky when IBM sent it out of its factory. It sure is now. And we don't know what to do about that. And I still yet to hear anybody tell us a good solution that all museum people will agree upon to do about those things. It's not a cut and dried issue right now. We have no consensus about people in the profession, paid profession to collect, what to do about that. This is very much an open question, and one which I think needs to be discussed some more in our next meeting, frankly. I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. Possibly. That's certainly a good approach. Then what happens if you only have one of them? Yes, well, guess what? I've got about a container or two full of one of something, and another container or two full of five or six or something. And even five or six, I have the question, what do I do with them? Back to who with. One of the nice things I like about Heinz Nixdorf's museum forum is they're in another continent. Because currently the Chack and Parham collections are halfway between the Hayward Fault and the San Andreas Fault. Do I want to keep everything California related or even Silicon Valley related that I have two of, or maybe even one of? Do I want to keep it in one place? Or should I spread it across the world in case something happens? Again, my primary mission is to preserve this for future generations. Not for the present, we've all had our chance scratching and sniffing. But what about succeeding generations? Being able to appreciate what's happening. Bit on this here. This event, today and tomorrow, is an effort at fenestration of computers, an effort to open the doors, open the windows to vintage computers, to share it with people. We're doing good, I think, among ourselves. I'm happy to see all of you. But I think we had the intent of sharing it to beyond those of us who are alike with strong interests and sharing it out to the general public. And we have yet to do that, and we've yet to do that in this country effectively. Because in this arena, I've told you of the good news about Heinz Nixdorf's museum forum, but I can tell you that the Computer Museum of Boston is not having such a good time. They're a $4 million a year operation in Boston, and they tried moving, or did succeed in moving, good chunk of their collection out to the West Coast, down here at Moffett Field, NASA Ames, in a warehouse, semi-public warehouse. They can kind of let you in at times. It's kind of storage, kind of exhibit, sort of 50-50, one of those sort of, we'll call visible storage. Nice, cute word, says we can't afford to really buy the full display technology. And they have tried since about a year and a half ago to raise enough money to make a good, decent, displayable location with parking in excess on a daily basis for people, and have failed substantially. Not failed because they don't have the resources. They're driven by the Bells, Gordon Bell and Gwen Bell. Gordon Bell of PDP8 fame, Gwen Bell of president of ACM fame, who are in their own right well-to-do people, with the ability to rub shoulders with well-to-do people, and have still had a very hard time. They haven't failed, but they haven't really succeeded to their desires, or for that matter, ours. And since we're sort of an also-ran organization, or organizations, that's pretty tough for us, because if they can't do it, we sure as hell can't. So one of the problems we've got is we're sitting at three containers, that's 8 foot by 8 foot by 20, stocked to the gunnels, of check. Three containers identified so far out of 32 of computer stuff for Param. Param didn't realize it had a computer collection until we started looking what they got. Stacked full. We've got a hypercube down in JPL storage, south of Pasadena, waiting for two things to happen. Me to get my butt down there and pick it up, and two, find a place to put it in the containers. We've got a very large warehouse in Woodland, 60, 70 miles that way, just west of Sacramento, with one of the largest collections of Apple stuff that Apple doesn't acknowledge exists anymore. Prototype material, test gear, documentation, stuff Apple has no record of, nobody else has record of, and we're out of space. Coming back to, what do we do with it after we get it? Check, in its 3 years of existence, has expended $20,000, as opposed to $4 million for a computer museum in Boston every year. We have tried raising money to purchase a collection from a local collector to keep it within the state of California about the past couple of months. We needed to raise $11,000 to do that. We failed miserably. We could not get more than about $1,000 committed to by our usual funding sources. And those are not foundations. Foundations aren't even considering this topic as being valid social worth yet. This is a collector's hobby, like collecting baseball cards, in their eyes. This is, does not do anything for social equality or good. So just private people who think this is worthwhile are already having second thoughts about the validity of moving this forward. Which leaves it to most of you as collectors of what's going to happen to the stuff. Because when my warehouse fills up and I get the call, what do I do next? What am I doing for time, Frank? You've got to...
It's quarter till four.
Why don't we break, and I suggest you think about some of these things. Come back at 4 o'clock. Quarter to four? Yeah. Come back at 4 o'clock. Is that when we're going to the panel?
Is that when the panel's supposed to be? I think that's what it was originally supposed to be. Four. I don't know if we've caught up.
Well, I'm going to declare we've caught up. With a 15-minute break, we'll start the panel at 4 o'clock, sharp, by the time on one of the computers somewhere in the room over there. And we want to hear from all of you some answers to the questions I'm posing, and some more.
Hold on a second. The panel is really supposed to be about why. Oh yeah, I know that the rest of it is, like I said, direct personal experience. I've been working with CHAC and have seen most of this stuff that Eddie's been talking about. Yeah, I've been spending about one day a week, half a day a week maybe, in these containers, going through stuff. Eddie's been spending more time. I've been up to that warehouse in Woodland. Boy, is it a mess. It's a corrugated, you know, it's a corrugated tin shed is what it is. Except it's about
half
the size of this room, you think? It's not entirely close to the elements.
Pigeon power!
Yeah, bird got in, let's put it that way. And not only that, Woodland is a kind of dusty place certain times of year. There's a thick layer of dust on anything that's exposed. And, you know, some of this stuff is just...
Yet we have a very hard time throwing any of it away.
Well, I guess maybe I'm to blame for that. Sometimes. It's getting easier. We have needed some convincing about the potential for saving some of this stuff. It's like what Eddie says about the cardboard boxes and things like that. I do know that there are people around here who are, you know, that I've heard comments within the collecting community about, you know, oh, it's in the original box. Well, I've seen some pretty sad original boxes, and they're water damaged. They're water damaged. They're bird crap damaged. Do we really want to take the effort to clean them up? Is it even possible? The foam packing material, foam rubber degrades. That's all there is to it. There's nothing we can do about that, as near as we can know. At least not with our current storage situation. So we have to have a really good reason to keep some of that stuff. The other part of it is that within Chag, at least, what we think we have, at least, is a computer collection. Not a foam rubber packaging collection. I have taken some convincing to get used to the idea of throwing some of this stuff out or, you know, recycling it or whatever. It's been hard, but yeah, I've had to come to grips with it, because otherwise, it's just a matter of how much effort are we going to be able to put into keeping it, and not being able to put that level of effort into it, the required level of effort into it, and make it something really excellent. Should we even keep it at all? I don't know. They're hard questions. The best thing I can say is, yeah, we think hard about it. It's not a light decision to throw something away.
Let me do a little math with you. What are the average price of the computers? What are the average price of the computers for sale next door? $50 to $100? What's the average value of the computers on display but not for sale behind the wall? So the average is maybe somewhere between $300 and $500 on average. Let's say, for argument's sake, that it's $1,000 per computer. And I have 1,000 computers that are worth $1,000. I have $1 million worth of computers. In order to house 1,000 computers appropriately in a display, I'm going to need to make a building that's going to cost me in this area minimum $5 million. By the time I pay for the display construction, the staff necessary, and the like, I may be pushing $10 million. When the value of the building is much higher than the value of what you're putting in the building, you have very significant trouble fundraising. If we take a look at the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco, an art museum, where the average value of a painting is what? $500,000? And we have 1,000 paintings in it. And the value of the building, right now scrap because they have to rebuild it because of the earthquake damage, but is, let's say, $10 million because the volume's about the same. We have a different situation. So I go back to the bullet I had on terms of goals. Increase the awareness, and awareness translates to value. I'm not necessarily talking about dollar value here, but it is the same thing, really. Psychological value and dollar value. Dollar value is how we rate psychological value of things. Otherwise, who would pay so much for a Mercedes? Sorry. That's the fundamental issue.
So I have two related questions. The first record related to that would be, what is Jack doing about awareness at this point? Is it actively, proactively,
we'll work with anybody to the extent they'll let us work with them. Let me answer that one first. The Boston Museum is an exercise, the dealing with the Boston Museum is an exercise in dealing with expectation differences, regional cultural differences, and class differences. Let me explain that a little bit further. When an institution that is used to $4 million a year deals with an institution its total budget over its entire life is $20,000, you've got an expectations issue difference. What takes them X amount of dollars to do may not take us X. In terms of cultural differences, they're the Computer Museum from Boston. We're from Silicon Valley. We're from California, we're from Western United States. There is a cultural difference, not anywhere as much as there is between going 10 feet in Europe, but there is a cultural difference.
A lot of people who are on the board.
Which brings us to the third one. Len is worth, I think, somewhere in the range of $40 million. Gwen and Gordon are certainly millionaires. I do not know what the numbers are. I think that the combined assets of Frank, me, and Kip, somewhere in the range of maybe less than $1 million. That's mainly because of my house and Kip's house. Okay? So we go to the class issue. They're millionaires, we ain't. And there's anything wrong about or right between each of those two parties. But there is differences, and those differences have not made it the easiest for us to cooperate. I think they've tried, and I think we've tried. But sometimes, as my boss tells me often, Eddie, you're very trying. We have had better luck with Heinz Nixdorf Museums Forum, possibly because they're much further away. We have no geographical competition with them. We have no funding competition with them. Although how can a $4 million a year operation really have problem with a $10,000 a year operation? But still, it's perceived, and that's maybe our foolishness for not understanding where that perception leads to conflict. I think as time is progressing, they're becoming more comfortable in being in our area, and we are being more comfortable in understanding what their issues are. To be honest with you, we definitely thought them as being a threat coming in, certainly the way they were coming in. but at the same time, they've learned that business is done a little differently out here than where they were used to practicing. They've learned their lesson. I hope we've learned ours. I hope they're going to continue learning. I hope we're going to continue learning. To that end, in fact, I'll say that for those of you who are in town, is it next Tuesday?
Yes, next Tuesday, 5:30.
Chris Espinoza and Larry Tesler of Apple fame. They've got a presentation in their store, in their visible storage area, which is a treat. And again, you know, their success is our success. I don't know if they consider our success being their success. That's one of the issues we still need to work on. But definitely, their success is very, very important to us. Perception, mainly. Because if they can't get people interested, who the hell's going to be interested in us? To your second question, what is CHAC doing from outreach? Not much, given that we're only about 5 to 10 people at most. Not many of us able to put much time in it. This is CHAC's main product, the Analytical Engine. It's a magazine. This is pretty much the number of issues that have come out since inception. We try and document the stories that nobody else has been documenting. The total subscription of this magazine is 100. The total subscription since day one has stayed at 100. Market research tells us that it's going to stay at 100 for quite some time, or thereabouts. This magazine does not run at a gain, does not break even. In fact, it runs at a $500 loss per printing 4 times a year.
And let me give you all another quote. I believe enough in that magazine to have underwritten its printing costs for the last 2 issues.
We're tentatively looking at killing the printing, putting it on the web. But that's what we need some feedback from. This meeting is our market research. Sam has been quite ambitious and adventurous in biting off this. And as such, we've been very eager to know the results, because his results are going to be our results. And so far, we do not see many discrepancies on the curve for him, for us, for Boston Museum. And I'll throw another statistic at you. Heinz Nixdorf's Museum Forum had 70,000 people come by its museum last year, its first year of opening its doors. Of those 70,000 people, I think 5 were Americans who happened to be visiting Siemens next door and were taken over for a look. Maybe the grass is greener on the other side of the big puddle. Maybe we're more fascinated with some things that happen thousands of miles away, and they're the same way. What can we do in the future? It really depends on what you tell us. What you tell us in the panel discussion coming up, what you tell us privately, and what you do with your own private collections. Because there's another possibility here. In order to get the discrepancy of the building or preservation cost, if you think of the Getty Museum, versus the value of the artifacts, balanced. In this particular case, you need to be lit like this in order to get it to flow. You need to have viable collectors who are paying substantial amounts of money for it such that there is a worth to the artifacts. Now, it's going to be a little bit difficult for you because you really guys, you know, you don't want to pay a large amount of money for the computers. I have good news. You buy it now, you save it, and 20 years from now, you sell it at a nice good profit to the collectors who got the money. Consider that you have the Computer Museum of Boston doing what they're supposed to do, and the Smithsonian doing what it's supposed to do, taking off the currently most valuable and significant artifacts and storing them. But is that all that needs to be preserved? This lady on our cover of one of our past issues, an accountant. She programmed her own computer in BASIC, like everybody should. Pardon. Her computer hardly had an operating system. I don't even think it really did have an operating system. It's a company called Logical Products out of Sunnyvale. Logical Machines. Glomac. We can't find any information on it. Certainly nobody's told us any stories in the books we've read on it. We've captured just one story. We know there are a bunch more. Do you think the Smithsonian knows about this? Do you think the Bells know about this? Do you think they care about this? Should they care about this? Should you care about this? Should the future generations care about this? That's what we need to know. All right, am I tilting at windmills? Or am I doing something that is valued? Yes, the very earliest large mainframes, the first of significant computers, they fetch a good value already. But they're already in the Smithsonian, they're already in the Computer Museum in Boston, they're already in Heisenberg Source Museum Forum, they're already in 20 other places, and they're taken very good care of. I'm talking about second tier, third tier history. Stuff that fleshes out the storyline.
The computer companies themselves aren't holding on to their own collections.
Yeah.
They shut down their own in-house museums for a large part.
Like Apple itself, which not only shut down its museum, but then it's turned out a couple weeks ago to shut down its own library, which was a functioning museum. So, again, we need to know what at least those who have interest in the subject matter think we should be doing. Is it what the Smithsonian and the Bells, what they've preserved, is that enough? Certainly it's necessary and needs to be done. I don't think anybody argues that. They're doing it, they have the funding for doing it, and that's good. And there's no way in the world an organization like CHAC, or an organization like PERM, can do such functions. We don't have the budget, we don't have the staff, we don't have the experience, we don't have the place to put it, we don't have the place to share it. But for additional materials below that, the supporting materials, the things that answer more deeply contemplating questions about the history of this era, how far do we need to go? When does it really turn into junk? And should it, at that point, go to the dump? What is that level? And there's only one people that can tell us the answer to that, and that's you. And your friends, people you know who do the same things you do, who look and interested in and collect vintage computers. Does that give you enough idea of where we're at? Do you understand that the answer I've given you is not an answer, it's just another set of questions? That's the problem. That's the fundamental problem. We don't have the answer.
I hate to cut you off, but we got to
listen to the panel.
To the panel. So in about 10 more minutes. Well, that was it. Did you have a, did you get a chance to give them a subscription address or something that they can?
Since we're contemplating shutting down the issue of subscription, because this is not viable right now. I've got back issues. I don't have them with me today. I'll have them tomorrow. I'll have them for sale then. The URL is www.chat.org.
http://.
Do we need that?
www.chac.org/.
And in that URL is a listing of other URLs to jump to also. There's one I would say I've mentioned. Give me Hal Lair's URL, do you remember? Is it MMM?
I don't remember, it's my machine. I don't remember the URL.
That's a much better web page. You know, this we're very proud of. This is first class stuff in our eyes. Our web page, quite frankly, sucks. It's dusty deck.
There's parts of it that are nice, and there are parts of it that are definitely dusty deck.
And so that's the other thing. Where do we put our efforts? And we're trying to transition that. So.
How much for a setback?
Sorry?
How much will a setback cost?
I don't know. I gotta go find out. I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you. Where you live? You come play with us. You get a set for free. I'll get the better of the deal, I know.
I don't know if you call it play, but anyway.
Well, isn't that what this is, playing? Certainly not work. Did everybody get this?
There's anybody? More out on the table.
Okay, if anybody wants more copies, more than what are around here, I've got an infinite supply of these.
So stack up a trading post in the middle of the...